This episode of Bossaval Podcast is sponsored by Seekney. Seekney is a modern version of an employee satisfaction questionnaire that helps you bring out the meaning in work. I tried it out, and it was pretty impressive. So first of all, it was technically well implemented. It didn't have the usual feel of a paper form that has simply been converted into a web form. Second, the questions were relevant and made me think. Just answering the questionnaire was useful. And third, the questions were so insightful that I was intrigued to hear what the results were going to be. Seekney loves Bossaval Podcasts, so they're offering listeners a €500 discount on the first package you purchase. Just mention that you heard about the questionnaire on Bossaval when purchasing. You can find more information on Seekney.fi, that's Seekney.fi. The link is in the show notes. Welcome back to Bossaval. Let's start off with a listener question.
Hello, Sami. My name is Janne Karjalainen. I've heard you mention a couple of times retrospectives as one of the best tools for developing teams. Would you happen to have any pointers or advice on how to run retrospectives?
So yes, in my opinion, retrospectives are one of the most crucial practices in creating a thriving team or company. You don't always need the formal facilitated retrospective, but the ability to learn about our environment and our actions together is a key to success, and retrospectives are a great way for bringing that about. Running great retrospectives is an art form. You need to assess the current state of the team, the project, the business, the people, the past, the future, everything you can get your hands on, and design something that's right for that specific context at that specific moment. So basically, there is no single format that just always works, since people and situations are always so different. But however, I do have a format that's basically my go-to format for any kind of facilitated event. It's kind of like a good default to start from and then modify as needed. I've used it to facilitate meetings, coaching sessions, employee development discussions, full-day strategy workshops, all sorts of stuff. It's basically an adaptation of the GROW model developed by Sir John Whitmore. GROW stands for Goal, Reality, Options, and Way Forward. You start with a discussion on the goal. What is this team trying to accomplish? What would be an ideal end state? What does the world look like when we succeed? It can feel a little awkward to start discussing the goal, since people tend to feel it's self-evident. Yet I found that the discussion on goal is almost always helpful, no matter how self-evident it might initially seem. It's also important to start with the goal instead of the current situation, since having a common understanding of the big picture can help the rest of the discussions in the retrospective. Generally, it also tends to bring a positive vibe to the rest of the session. Next is talking about reality, the current state of things. This is where me and my friend Arto Eskelinen, whom I used GROW extensively with, decided to adapt the framework. So instead of reality, we thought it's better to talk about learning. So the model becomes GLOW instead of GROW. In my experience, talking about the current state is often the least useful part of a retrospective. We get caught up in the problems we're having. We humans, we just love talking about our problems. And it's very easy to start blaming others. But unfortunately, talking about our problems is not very useful. So me and Arda, we decided to reframe it and talk about learning instead. So what have we learned about the things we've done so far? Learning has a much more positive and solutions-focused feel. Then you start discussing options. It's important to distinguish this from the next step where we decide what we want to do. So in the options phase, you're not committing to anything. You're just generating options. And at this point, quantity is often more important than quality. So you need to find at least three options on what you might want to do next. And then we move to the last phase of the GLOW model, which is way forward, where we actually decide on what option or options we're going to pick. And then we go into details of like how to actually make them happen. I like running retrospectives with post-it notes, and my default technique is called me, we, us, which you can basically use to facilitate each part of the GLOW model. So the idea behind me, we, us is that people first work by themselves, the me part, then in small groups, the we part, and then together, the us part. So first, you simply ask everyone to stay silent and write their ideas on post-it notes by themselves, one idea per post-it note. And if you have a larger group, if it's larger than, let's say, 9, then it's probably a good idea to do the we part, where participants go into groups of 3 or 4 and share their ideas with each other. And then, in the last phase, we put all the ideas on a wall and discuss them. To read more on retrospectives, there's a book called Agile Retrospectives by Esther Derby and Diana Larson, which you might want to check out. To be honest, I don't really remember much from it, because I read it when it came out 10 years ago, but I think it was pretty good, so check it out. The link is in the show notes. Okay, let's get to today's episode. On this episode, I'm interviewing Simon Wardley. We're talking about Wardley maps, which are Simon's method for co-creating strategy with visual and context-specific maps. There's a link to an example of a Wardley map in the show notes, and you might want to take a look at that now to make the episode a little easier to understand. But basically, you create a Wardley map by making a diagram of the needs of a customer and the underlying dependencies of those needs. So, for example, for an e-commerce site, you might start with the customer wanting to buy clothes online. And for that to be possible, you need a website, and the website needs a hosting service. In addition, you might want to have a CRM system. And this dependency tree becomes the y-axis of your Wardley map. You then spread out the dependencies on the x-axis by thinking about their evolution. So, are the components you've mapped out something that you need to invent a completely new solution for, or is it something that you can buy as a service? The current evolutionary state of the components from genesis to commodity becomes the x-axis. And as a result, you will have mapped out your business and can make better decisions based on the newfound understanding. However, it's important to remember that the most important thing is the co-creation of the map, not the map itself. So as always, it's the understanding we create by going through the process that matters. Enjoy the episode.
So my name is Simon Wardley. I work for an organization called the Leading Edge Forum. I specialize in situational awareness. How do you understand the competitive environment that you exist within?
Okay, and how did you end up doing this?
Oh, purely by accident. Just a random set of events. So I started off many years ago, normal sort of like software development, ended up as the CEO of a subsidiary for Canon. And we were competing against other organizations. I looked at our strategy documents and realized they were pretty much the same as everybody else's. This was in 2004. Actually, there was an event about 10 years earlier where I'd been working for a company. I was in a lift in of the Arts Hotel in Barcelona, and a senior vice president had given me a strategy document and asked me, what did I think of this? And I looked at it, and I had no clue. I had no idea whatsoever, but it had familiar words, so I said, it looks good. Because obviously they're just testing me. I didn't want to look like the person who didn't know anything. And so anyway, about 10 years later, I'm CEO of this company, and we had our strategy, and it's pretty much the same as everybody else's. I'm saying there's something wrong here. And I handed it to somebody else and said, what do you think of this? And they looked at it, and I said, well, it looks good. And I was just thinking, you're just saying what I say. You don't have a clue. And what's really shocking is I don't have a clue either, and I'm the one in charge.
I like the font.
Yeah. Well, it was like, you know, I was sitting there like feeling, God, I was feeling like I was the fake CEO.
Yeah.
I ended up in this position. I'm supposed to be, defining the strategy, helping, directing the organization. And Yeah, I'm looking at it. I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm sort of wanting to be like that SVP in that lift. I was still convinced at that time that obviously they knew what they were doing. It's obviously I just missed all the lessons. I hadn't done an MBA. I hadn't read the right books. And therefore, I'd missed all the lessons on how to write a good strategy. So I kept on looking at the problem and started to realize that there was something missing. And I read The Art of War by Sun Tzu.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about five factors that matter: having a purpose, moral imperative, understanding your landscape, understanding climatic patterns like the weather, understanding doctrine, as in universal ways of operating, and then strategy, which is more context-specific gameplay. And I realized I was missing totally the concept of landscape. So what I had was, well, we had a purpose, as in, why we wanted to be the best of this. And then we were just jumping straight into strategy. And there was obviously some sort of landscape we were competing in, and we were totally oblivious to it. So I realized, okay, I needed some sort of map. And I looked at maps. I looked at a lot of military maps as well as geographical. And I realized, there's a couple of things that we needed. It's got to be visual. It's got to be context specific, as in the battle, the game at hand. But we also need an anchor. So in geographical maps, that's the compass. In say, a chess game, it's the board. We need position of pieces, and we need to see a concept of movement. And I looked around at all the diagrams that we had, and none of them had those characteristics. They had some of them, sorry, but they didn't have them all. So I developed a mechanism of mapping where you start with the user needs, you understand that user needs require certain components. Those components have needs, so you can create a chain of needs from the visible components to the user and the invisible components underneath that. So if you think about a cup of tea, if a user needs a cup of tea needs a cup, it needs water, needs tea, the hot water has needs, it needs cold water, it needs a kettle, kettle has needs, it needs power. The user doesn't care about your power source. They do. They care about the cup of tea. So you can create a value chain. The problem is that gives you, it's context specific, it's visual, it gives you an anchor, the user, it gives you position, but no concept of movement, how things are changing. So I developed a technique, an evolution axis, so how things actually evolve, not diffuse, but because what happens is things appear, they diffuse in society, and you get better versions and better versions which diffuse through ever-increasing markets. And you can't actually measure change by simply looking at adoption or time. I developed a mechanism of understanding evolution. So from the genesis of something to custom-built examples, products, and then commodity, utility, services, and use that as the other axis. And then I had a map. I had an anchor, I had position, I had movement. And once I had a map, then I could start to learn all sorts of climatic patterns, the rules of the game, all different forms of doctrine, all different forms of context-specific gameplay, and I started to use them.
Okay, so and you started calling them Wardley maps, and what do you think, like, if you were to summarize the benefits that you've seen in companies using Wardley maps?
So, I call them Wardley maps because I'm unimaginative. I call them value chain maps to begin with, and, I just called them maps, actually, to begin with. And then other people had other terms. And there were so many competing terms, I thought, I'll just call them Wardley maps.
Yeah, it's simple.
It's easy. Just simple. It's not like these other ones, okay? Now, I use them at the company I ran, and we use them for determining strategic play, which markets to attack. And then I use them at Canonical, which provides Ubuntu. We use that to understand the market and where to attack. And then I wrote something called the Better for Less paper with several other people. The main author was a wonderful chap called Liam Maxwell. And so I was one of the co-authors on that, and I used the mapping concepts there. But it wasn't until 2011, roughly, so 6 years after I'd started mapping, that I started to realize that maybe other people weren't mapping. Because I still assumed everybody was like, you know, they obviously had a mechanism of understand the landscape, which they'd all learned on MBAs or
but isn't that
the book.
I think that's one of the things that, like, in business, I think what happens to me, at least, all the time is, like, the more people I meet, I always have an image in my head that he's such a big boss that, like, he has to have, like, secrets that I don't know about.
Oh, I assume
then,
that, yes.
Yeah, and then when you meet them, you're like, no, he's just a regular person.
So
no magic powers.
Well, no, I spent 6 years thinking I had this cheap and cheerful way of doing it, and I was using it, and it was getting results, but obviously everybody else was doing it the proper way.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's just because, you know, and then I started to realize after talking to people, I would draw a map and people would go, what's that? And I would go, well, that's the gameplay we should have. No, what's that thing there? Oh, the map. Well, it's just a map. How do you do that? And it was like, what?
Why are you interested in that?
it's like you make furniture for others and somebody comes up and says, that's really interesting. Well, you like my furniture? No, that thing in your hand. What, the chisel? Yes,
yeah.
The that thing, chisel. What's that? What's that?
Exactly, yeah.
And you're like, well, how do you make furniture if you haven't got a chisel?
Yeah.
So it was a real state of confusion and shock for me. And I made this stuff all Creative Commons. And people have used it for removing duplication bias, strategic gameplay, getting alignment between different parts of the organization, learning about their environment. It's like playing game of chess, where you suddenly, you know, you imagine a world where everybody plays chess and no one's seen the board. And all you do is press buttons on a screen, as in, you know, you've got one for pawn, one for queen, one for king, and it's all sequence based. And then somebody comes along and says, look, here's a chess board. It's quite a revelation, a change. So it's used all over the place. Well, I say all over the place in my community, people I know, but I keep on getting companies coming up to me that I've never heard of before, suddenly saying, oh, we're using your mapping stuff. It's like, it's always a big shock.
Yeah. So what do you think, like, how is it different? How's doing Wardley maps different from any of the other, like, strategic planning methods that we have?
So most of the techniques that I've seen don't actually have a form of map. To map an environment, you need those basics of visual, context-specific. You've got to have an anchor to give you position and movement. You need those characteristics in order to learn. I haven't seen other systems which have those characteristics. They often have flow between components. That's like, so if you've got a map of an environment, you may have troops. Obviously, flow is the speed at which they communicate with each other. And that's great, but if they're in the wrong position or they're moving in the wrong way, it doesn't really help. And these maps, by the way, are Babylonian clay tablets. I mean, this is a really primitive form of mapping. It's different from storytelling. And someone will, without doubt, make a better version of mapping. But they seem to be useful. People like them. Mm. They use them. So I suppose that's all I can ask for. Mm,
sure. So how about, like, one of the first things that come to mind with, like, with maps is, like, how do you create such a map that it's actually accurate? I mean, placing things...
Oh, you don't bother. So the key thing about this is maps fundamentally force you to start with the user need and put down your assumptions of the components on the environment. And by doing that, your visual assumptions are on paper. It allows other people to challenge. And so you get a discussion. So as a group, you come together to agree what an environment is like. And then you can start talking about, what if we start moving these components? Because there's ways of manipulating the map. You can speed things up with open approaches, slow evolution down if you want to, with patterns or restricting things such as underlying components. You can use constraints. There's all sorts of different forms of gameplay. So it's mainly a discussion document. Now, to make a perfect map, so think about a geographical map. A perfect map of France would be one-to-one scale, which means it would be the size of France, which means it would be of no use to anyone.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all approximations.
Sure.
but it's a way of discussing.
Sure. So are you saying that essentially the most important thing is co-creating the map and the discussions that you have when you're creating the map and not the map itself?
Oh, absolutely. So I, many years ago, did a piece of work which looked at the media industry and developed a way of manipulating that environment. And then Amazon launched Lumberyard, which is a AAA gaming engine. And somebody online tweeted to me, hey, that looks like a similar gameplay. So I quickly mapped it out and sent it to them, and they modified it and sent it back to me. And we're doing this all online on Twitter. And before you knew it, somebody from the gaming industry was involved and was changing the map and everything else. And at the end, we had a map of the environment within the space of an hour or so with what we thought the gameplay was. And the point is, we could discuss this. It didn't matter that one came from IT, one came from business, one was a game designer. Mm. We could all discuss the gameplay that was going on. So yes, co-creation, massively important.
So how does the maps make decision-making easier? Like, what kind of decisions can you make with the map?
So when you have a... So there's several different parts to this. So you map out environments, and you have several other people, so you have that process of challenge to try to more accurately reflect what is there. And then there's all sorts of things like doctrine. There's all different types of doctrine, like are you focusing on user needs? Well, if you're building a map, that's where you start with. The second one is like different methodologies. So there's points, you know, if you're less evolved components, you're going to use, you know, an XP, very light XP type approach. As those components evolve, so more in the middle of the map, you're going to use more like lean, so maybe Scrum with other artifacts like MVP, because you're no longer about just discovering, you're about learning. So you are removing waste. And then eventually as it evolves, you're going to use much more structured like Six Sigma, because you're now about removing deviation. It's volume operations based. So you learn that multiple methods need to be used. Same with purchasing. One side is more VC-based, the other side, you know, it's more unit utility, and in the middle, it's outcome and maybe COTS. So you learn to use multiple different methods. Second thing, you know, you start then learning how to organize around it, cell-based structures. You start to break down contracts into smaller parts. Then, because you've learned economic patterns, turns out that not everything in the economy is unpredictable. There are certain things. Like if you've got supply and demand competition, things will evolve or tend to evolve unless there's specific constraints or ways of people are manipulating it. So you can anticipate the movement of parts of the map, and so you can prepare for that. And that's important for things like when people talk about disruption. There's two forms of disruption that I'm aware of. One is highly unpredictable, and that's product discontinuity. So that's like Apple versus Nokia. You don't know which way it's going to go. But there's another form, which is the product to utility shift. So that's like cloud computing, where you know that it's going to happen because of supply and demand competition. You know that past vendors are going to start behind inertia barriers. That's another pattern. You know it's going to cause an explosion of higher order systems. You know it's going to cause co-evolution of practice. So we got things like DevOps. So there's a lot you do know about, and you can anticipate it in advance. So there's two forms of disruption that normally hits companies. One is highly unpredictable. You just have to react quickly. And for that, it all depends upon culture. And another form, which you can anticipate well in advance and plan for, and you shouldn't be disrupted by. But because what happens, organizations can't see their landscape. They treat them as the same. They don't even realize there's potentially predictable forms. And so you start off with, you know, doctrine organization. You then get into anticipation. And then you start to learn about context-specific gameplays, ways of manipulating the environment to your favor. So if you think about a battle, to explain the difference... You might use a flanking movement. That's context specific. That depends upon the opponent being at a particular place. Or you might use suppressive fire. Again, context specific. But suppressive fire requires soldiers to be able to shoot guns. And so that is, you know, doctrine. You do that beforehand. You don't, in the middle of a battle, go, right, we need to use suppressive fire, or go off and learn how to shoot a gun.
Yeah.
And when people copy from other organizations, so they go, oh, what's Uber doing? What's Amazon doing? If you're simply copying, you don't know whether you're copying universal doctrine or it's context specific, and whether that context is the same as yours. So you go, Uber's doing surge pricing. We should do surge pricing. But what if you're a funeral parlor? I mean, surge pricing for funerals. Oh, I'm sorry, we've just had a run on coffins. I mean, and unfortunately in business, a lot of what we do is simply meme copy.
Yeah, yeah. If a company wants to create a Wardley map for themselves, how should they start that process?
Oh, so to begin with, buy my training course. No, buy my book. No, it's all Creative Commons. See, so the first thing you have to accept is you have to do it yourself. You can't get a consultant in to do. The only people who can play the game of chess are those who are actually playing the game. So you have to start yourself. The first thing you need to do is get an idea of what your user needs are. That's actually a big shock for most organizations, because often they don't think about user needs. Then you've got to start thinking about the components and that are required. And then you have to think about how evolved they are. I have a Creative Commons book on Medium. Search for Wardley maps.
I can put the link in the show notes. So.
Fantastic. I'm up to chapter 8. Okay. It's taken me about 10 years to write after several attempts. There's about another 16 chapters to go. I'm just trying to take people through the basic process. And I've got a horrendous blog, which has it all in, but it's spread over the last 10 years, so it's a mess. So I'm trying to tidy that up. But yeah. Start with user needs, think about the components, then you think about how evolved, and share the maps. Now, the key is start small. Don't try and do the Death Star, let's map the entire environment. It's an iterative process. So you start off by, what's our purpose? Okay, let's understand the landscape. Then you start to learn about climatic patterns, doctrine. Then you start to learn about basics of strategy. So that's ACT. Mm-hmm. And as a result of acting, you'll change your purpose, potentially. You'll change the landscape. In fact, just mapping out the landscape can help you redefine what your purpose actually is. So it's a process of start small, start iteratively, start with user needs, understand the value chain, and then just map it over evolution. And that's where you begin.
So how about time-wise? How long should you take to build your first Wardley map?
Well, for me, I can take half an hour and create a map of a particular problem or an industry, depending on how well I know it. The first time people do it, they often spend like a week or something like that. That's perfectly normal. Remember, it's a thing which is going to be constantly changing, so it's something you want to come back to all the time. But most of that is just people getting used to the process and challenging each other and having arguments, you know. Oh, what do you mean payroll as a commodity? House is custom built. Surely it's that process of challenging and discovering. Actually, we're spending vast amounts of money doing things in custom ways that actually we shouldn't. And there's no harm with that. The one thing you don't try and do is create the perfect map. If you sit there in a room on your own, trying to create the perfect map, by the time you've finished, it'll be wrong because everything's moved anyway.
Yeah, it's outdated. Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that very often happens is that the artifacts become the most important thing, and you're kind of so focused on like, what are the rules of creating this artifact? Is this now a perfect artifact? And am I following all the advice?
Have I ticked the box?
Exactly. And you kind of miss the point that it's the discussions and it's the process that's more important.
Yeah. Okay. So my piece of advice on that. I've got blog posts on how to create a Wardley map. So spend an hour reading that. Maybe spend a few hours reading some of the others. Create a map. And if you don't find the map useful within, I don't know, a week or whatever, if you don't find the process useful, throw it away. What you don't want to do is don't be, oh, We've got to create one of these maps because, you know, we've got a tick box. We need a map. You want to be in the position that you're creating a map because you find it useful. So if you don't do it. Just throw it away. Use whatever other method you wish.
Mm, yeah. So how are you hoping that Wordly Maps will change the way that companies do strategy work? I mean, so in other words, what are you hoping to get rid of?
Oh, yeah. My pet desire is to get rid of all strategy consultancy firms and get people actually doing strategy for themselves. I mean...
What's your gripe with strategy consultants?
Oh,
because I think there is one.
No, it's I don't have a gripe with them. It's more a thing of, you know, this is something people, you know, if you're playing the game of chess, you need to learn how to play the game of chess. You can't constantly turn around to somebody and say, what should my next move be? That one, okay. What's my next move? You're not playing the game. You may as well. And people need to get an understanding of the landscape. So, unfortunately, people, execs are busy people. And so there's always the tendency, I want ready-made, easy solutions. And there's an entire industry ready to provide them for you. Many times I was sort of suckered into that path as well. Unfortunately, the environments we compete in are complex environments. And we have to develop the capability to understand. There are no magic solutions. There's no like 2x2 framework, which if I do that thing, I will be a success because everybody else will do that thing. You are competing against others. So you need to learn how to play the game. And it is a game. You have to apply thought. So, you know, my hope for mapping is people find it useful. And companies learn how to play strategic games themselves. They use it as a learning environment. And hopefully someone else will make a better map. That would be nice.
I'm fond of the idea that strategy should be created through experiments so that instead of a company crafting a strategy, they empower employees to do tiny experiments all the time and then scale up the ones that work, and that the strategy is born out of successful experiments that we continue scaling up. So what are your thoughts on that?
So perfectly valid in certain places. So if you think about... when you have a map, you've got the evolution scale at the bottom. We're going from the genesis of new activities. That's the uncharted space where things are chaotic, uncertain, unpredictable. You don't know what's going to appear in that space. And then it evolves over time. So it doesn't matter whether it's money, penicillin, or computing. It evolves and becomes highly industrialized. Different set of characteristics, ordered, known, standard, dull. This is the Salomon innovation paradox of 2002. And, of course, there's the transition in the middle. So at points, you're all about experimentation, the uncharted space. But there's other bits, like the shift from product to utility, that... you know you can anticipate that's going to happen, and so you can plan for. And so you can have an idea of what your gameplay should be before that event occurs. So yes, I'm all for experimentation, but that doesn't say that everything has to be experimentation. There are points you can anticipate, and you can actively manipulate a market.
Do you think that it's possible that by doing this categorization that some part is now like a commodity, that you stop innovating in that part because you've kind of labeled it as a commodity, and there are situations that like if you still treat it as an opportunity, you would find something new in that area?
Always. That's always possible. I mean, there's lots you can do with manipulation as well. My favorite, my hero is Gary Dahl. So Gary Dahl bought some builder's rubble, just rocks. He didn't clean the rocks. What he did is he put the rocks in a box with some cardboard and a leaflet saying how to look after your pet rock, and sold it for about $15, $20 a pop, something that cost five cents. There's all sorts of ways of taking something which is a commodity and manipulating it so that people think it's somehow special, you know.
There was an iPhone app called I Am Rich, which like it just had a diamond. It just showed a diamond on your phone, and it cost I think $10,000 to purchase. And 16 people I think managed to purchase this before Apple threw it out of the store. But it's still, I mean, that guy made a lot of money.
made a good chunk for a picture of a diamond. Exactly. I mean, fantastic. I mean. So there's lots you can do with marketing perception, manipulation, etc., to persuade people that something which is a commodity isn't a commodity. And then, of course, there's lots of things hidden behind the commodity. So whereas, you know, if you look at a plug, the interface doesn't change. Behind that is an entire industry generating that electricity, and there's all sorts of novel new innovations, as in the genesis of new things appearing in that space. But the interfaces tend to obscure that. If you change the interfaces, of course, there's all sorts of impacts to that. If you suddenly went around saying all plug interfaces will change, that requires normally government action or something along those lines, because the impacts that it would have. And the interesting thing is, when you use standard components for things which are commodity, it accelerates it's one of the patterns, your ability to build new things. So that's componentization. It's quicker to build a house using bricks and planks than it is to build a house using, I don't know, a clay pit and a forest. And my favorite, Thomas Thwaite, he decided to build a toaster. It's amazing. It's the toaster project. So he took an ordinary toaster, cost, I don't know, £20 or whatever. I took it apart and found it had 400 components. So he simplified it to about 150 and decided to build it from scratch. So raw materials.
All of it.
Oil for plastics, you know, ore for the... And 9 months later and £1,000 later or whatever it was, I had something which sort of looked like a toaster. And of course, the first time he used it, burst into flames. Now, if you're a user, you know, you want a piece of toast. And there's a 20. So your choice is, can I have the £20 toaster? Or do I buy the custom built £1,000 toaster, which the first time I use it will burst into flames? And of course, it's easy. But it's amazing how many corporations are doing the equivalent. Thomas Thwaite building, particularly in, well, it's not just IT, it's all over the place. They're building their, almost like their own toaster. Crazy. It's fun.
That's a good example. Is that online? Can I find more information about that?
The toaster project? Yeah, if you search toaster project, it's a wonderful, wonderful story. Brilliant. Awesome. I'm probably getting some of the details wrong, but it's well worth it. I think he was at the Royal College of Arts. I just love that example.
I remember seeing this this video online where this guy builds a hut from scratch, from nothing, like in a forest. Mm-hmm. And I was just completely amazed that, like, I was thinking that if I was in a forest and I had to build a hut, I have no idea what to do.
So this is fascinating, because, well, for me it's fascinating. I sort of hope it might be for your listeners. Otherwise,
I'll just edit it out.
Edit it out. Apologies for the damage that I've caused you. So there's this process of coevolution. So what happens if you take an activity like, say, compute, because we've gone through cloud, so that's a good one to do. Compute used to be a product, as in server. And so when we built applications, we developed architectural practices based upon the idea of compute as a product. And compute as a product has high, what's known as MTTR, mean time to recovery. So if your compute goes bang, it takes ages to get a new server in. So we built architectural practices, things like M+1, so highly resilient components, scale up bigger machines, disaster recovery tests. Now what happens is the activity evolved to a utility, so Amazon, etc. And here it's low MTTR, low mean time to recovery. So when your machine goes pop, your virtual machine, it just takes seconds to, you know, recreate a new virtual machine. So we develop new architectural practices, distributed systems, design for failure, chaos engines, and they are evolving and becoming sort of good, eventually best practice for a utility world. So what you have is best practice, architectural practice for a product world, which is different from good to best practice for a utility world. And so we have on one side legacy, as in applications built with best practice for a product, and we have DevOps, as in applications built with, well, say good at the moment, good practice for a utility. Over time, the legacy will die off. Everything becomes a utility. And so we get to the point that some point in the future, if you wanted to build your own computer or develop something with a standalone computer, we've lost
the capability.
The practice. Yeah. And, you know, we'd have to reinvent lots of the sort of things that we take for granted now. They will be gone.
Yeah.
And it's the same with, you know, somebody says, oh, I want to make a sword I want to make my own sword. Well, you can go and buy one, mass produced and all the rest of it, or like a toaster. But if you want to develop it yourself from raw materials, and this was the problem with Thomas Thwaite found, is just doing the basics of like taking an ore and melting it. It's really, really difficult, but the practice is not there. He had to resort to things like using microwaves, leaf blowers, all sorts of things, trying to recreate what were once best practice.
Do you ever think about like what would you be able to bring with you if you were flown back in time 1,000 years? Like, and what would you be able to recreate? Like, how do you create electricity? And like,
oh yeah, if you go back 1,000 years, spare set of clothes. I mean, you know, all the things we have, like money. Well, that won't be much use.
Not going to help.
I brought my iPhone. Well, that's not much use. A, the battery's running out, and B, there's nothing to connect with.
Yeah.
So there is no, you can't call anyone. There is no internet. There's no GPS.
Yeah.
I mean, it can take a photo, great, until it runs out. Or I can show you my picture of a diamond. Or whatever it happens to be.
You could be a magician for 6 hours or something.
The most valuable thing on it would be the fact that it flashes light.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
People will go, wow, he's got a candle.
Exactly.
So, yes, unfortunately, we build a lot of what we build today, the incredibly complex systems that we have, depend upon components underneath which are highly industrialized.
Mm.
And at the same time that this enables us to create ever greater technology and protect us from, say, future threats, like being able to predict if an asteroid is going to hit us, at the same time, it also exposes us to greater doom in terms of the underlying components. Well, what happens, you know, if we get a Carrington event and all the electricity sort of like, generation goes? I mean, our doom and future all walk hand in hand.
I think we're pretty good. Do you have any other topics that you think we should cover or should have covered?
Oh, gosh. No. Yeah, we've covered the world.
It is all. Okay, well, I guess that's a good place to stop.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for making it this far. Now is a good time to send this episode to your colleagues and agree on a time when you're going to try making your first worldly map. You can read more on the process on Simon's Medium page. The link is in the show notes. Currently, about 45% of the listeners of this podcast are from Sweden, so I'd love to find a Swedish sponsor for the podcast. If you're interested, drop me an email at sami@bosslevelpodcast.com. If you have questions that you'd like to get an answer for on the podcast, you can send them to me at the same address, sami@bosslevelpodcast.com. Reviews on iTunes and shares on social media are always welcome and highly appreciated. Thank you for listening and have a great week.